Robert Trujillo, thanks for talking to us.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Can you tell me how you first became aware of Jaco Pastorius?
Well, you know, back in the 70s, it was a great time for music, and I was fortunate to have had parents that were young enough to turn me on to a lot of different styles. You know, back in our household, you know, my mom would be dancing to Motown and James Brown and all that super cool soul music and funk music. But at the same time, we had the Rolling Stones, we had Led Zeppelin, and of course I had my cousins and then my friends and their older brothers who were all listening to Black Sabbath and the heavier side of rock. So I was just surrounded by a lot of inspiring styles. And what happened with Jaco was I wanted to play drums, but we lived in an apartment, couldn't get a drum set going in the apartment. And then I wanted to play synthesizers because I was into Yes and Genesis and a lot of the prog stuff. But then again, you got to start with a piano. Couldn't get a piano in the apartment. But my dad's friend at the time had a hollow body bass guitar. And it didn't work through an amp, but I could hear it because it was hollow body. So I started playing that. And basically, word around town was that there was this bass player who was amazing called Jaco, one name. And it was mysterious to me. So I was like, oh, man, Jaco, wow. Everyone's going, this guy's incredible. Oh, my God. You know, he's doing things no one's ever done. And plus, back then, it wasn't like you had the internet, you know. There was a lot of mystery because you didn't actually see the person right away, and sometimes hearing the music was a challenge. You'd have to wait on the radio to hear something. But the word around town was potent. The rumors were flying about how great he was. So I discovered him that way through, again, word of mouth, and then when I actually officially heard that first album, it blew me away. Blew me away in the same way that Eddie Van Halen, when you first heard the song, that Eruption, the guitar solo, as a young, inspired musician, you were going, what is that? Is that a synthesizer? Is that, you know, oh my God, never heard anyone play guitar like that. Well, Jaco had that same effect on me, to where it was like the bass, you know, it has a different sound. It's aggressive. It's funky. The style was pretty unique. And he was so well-rounded. And then when I saw what he looked like and actually saw him perform, that took it to a whole nother level, because it was like, this guy is really different. He's delivering the goods, you know, on stage as well. So it was a very special time. And again, I was fortunate to have, because of my parents, to have been able to go to a lot of shows, see a lot of these bands back then. And I saw Weather Report twice, and I saw the Word of Mouth Big Band twice as well. Well, I saw the big band one time, and then a year or two later, I saw Jaco with the scaled down version of that band.
So it sounds like that you became aware of him, and you heard that 1976 self-titled debut while you were still figuring out the bass and figuring out your own musicianship. How did his playing manifest itself in yours?
Well, that's a good question. Around that time, I was dabbling on the bass with my friend. We ditched school, you know. We'd cut school, and his brother was a bass player, so I would play his brother's bass, and then my friend would play drums, and then we'd plug in an electric guitar. And I remember I blew my friend's amp when I was playing my friend's older brother's amplifier. So, you know, I had the thing cranked all the way up. And so that was sort of my first experience experimenting with electric instruments and stuff. So what happened was, at a certain point, I wanted to learn how to write songs and compose. And what I did with Jaco's influence, instead of trying to learn Jaco solos or compositions note for note, I actually tried to sort of hone in on his technique and his feel. And with that, eventually I would write with the Infectious Grooves. I pretty much wrote all the music, my old band, the Infectious Grooves. So Infectious Grooves was completely inspired, at least from where I was, by Jaco Pastorius. And, you know, our singer, Mike Muir, who's the leader of the band Suicidal Tendencies, at the time he was coming from the Sex Pistols, and he was bringing in this sort of punk ingredient into that. So I always say Infectious Grooves was inspired by Jaco Pastorius with elements of Slayer and, you know, ska bands and punk bands. There's a lot of stuff going on there. But as far as the bass went, absolutely. It was 100% Jaco, which I thought was really cool. And again, you're younger. There are no rules. You know, you're just being creative.
Is there a particular Infectious Grooves song or bass lick where you really hear Jaco in particular?
For me, there's a song called Violin and Funky, which was this repetitive, very staccato kind of, it's almost like a pulsating, rotating pattern. Fairly simple, but in its simplicity, there was a certain, you know, Jaco had an incredible amount of, how do you say, the precision in his technique, and he was very, very, he could be very staccato and punchy, but he could also, like, basically sing melodies through his instrument. But for me, it was like more the funk approach, you know? So I would say the song Violin and Funky was influenced directly by his feel. And then there was also another song that I still hear on the radio called Therapy, which featured Ozzy Osbourne as a guest vocalist off the first album. The first album was entitled The Plague That Makes Your Booty Move. It's the Infectious Grooves. And Therapy was, you know, really influenced by Jaco. And there's other songs. There's a song called Cousin Randy that had a harmonic moment in there. And then with Suicidal Tendencies, the intro to You Can't Bring Me Down, I tried my best to do sort of a fretless, kind of a more of a vibe, you know. It was sort of the grand intro into this massive, this wall of distortion and riffage. And I opened the song with a fretless piece that I did. It was very cool. And again, it's me doing the best I could back then. The funny thing is now I'm actually learning Jaco compositions. I don't know. For me now, it's of course it's a challenge, but it's also fun. And being a part of the project this kind of the movement for Jaco right now. It's like, hey, I'm going to learn Donna Lee. I learned, you know, Teen Town, and I learned Portrait of Tracy last year. Yeah, so
that Portrait of Tracy is no small feat.
No, it isn't. It's a challenge, and part of it is, I guess, in a lot of ways, writing with the influence of Jaco is one thing, but then, you know, diving into his compositions, you know, that takes time, you know, it's time and effort, and you got to make time to learn that stuff.
There's an artificial harmonic in the main tune of Portrait of Tracy, mm-hmm. that I've mm-hmm. seen very, very talented bass players can't pull off because it's such a massive stretch. How do you do it?
Right. Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I have a problem with the harmonic chord that's at the very end of the composition. And I've talked to other bass players who all laugh about it because we all have a problem with the very final statement he makes is this harmonic chord. And a good friend of mine, Armand Sabaleko, incredible bass player from Cameroon. I write with Armand. I do a lot of stuff with him. But Armand used to hang with Jaco when Armand was about 18 years old. So this would have been very early 80s. And Jaco actually taught him the chord. But Armand kind of had to, like, really, you know, pester him to show him it. And then I asked Felix, past story. It's Jaco's, one of Jaco's sons, who's an amazing bass player. But I asked him, you know, so that last chord, what is it? You know, and he showed me, and it was the same. So those guys are on the same page, and there's direct lineage there. But yeah, it's a stretch, this one that I'm talking about. I think I've seen people try to do it with their thumb even, you know.
on the right hand, you mean?
On the left hand.
The thumb and then hit the harmonic with your pinky?
Exactly.
Oh, what a nightmare.
Yeah, I've seen people kind of trying to do that too. Jaco had massive hands, so he could pull that stuff off fairly easily.
So if you asked most people what they know about Jaco Pastorius, probably the first word that would come to mind is fretless. He's known as a fretless player. And you came across him when you were still very young. I'm surprised that you didn't go straight into fretless from that stage. You're not known as a fretless player.
No, I'm not. And it's kind of interesting. A lot of friends of mine who are active bass players, and they're working, you know, a lot of us, we're not fretless players, but we're totally and completely influenced by Jaco. And a lot of that has to do also with his attitude, which we can get into a little bit later, and his edge. But I have fretless basses. I mess around with them. You know, there's been times where I spent more time on a fretless. I remember back in, it would have been probably the mid to late 70s, maybe around 87, I had my first five-string bass. I might be the guy that was officially responsible for bringing five-string to metal, I guess. And it was because I liked the low B. Now, some people, maybe that's sacrilegious. You know, the funny thing is I play more four-string now than I ever have in my life. But at the time, I had my first five-string. And I was very excited about getting that thing. But just prior to that, the reason I got the five string is because someone had stolen this four string bass that I had custom made myself. I took it to a bar and I played it for one night. I set it in the corner, went off for a drink, and it was gone, you know, a half hour later. So it forced me to buy this five. So the only other instrument I had was a fretless. It was a Music Man fretless. So I ended up playing the Music Man fretless for about a year. That was the only instrument I had. So I had to play that thing. So at that time, you know, I dove a little bit harder into the instrument. And it is a whole different entity in a lot of ways. It's not easy to play. Intonation, all that stuff is a challenge. But Jaco played a lot of fretted too. I mean, Teen Town, if you go and you look at footage of Jaco, he's playing a fretted bass on Teen Town, which is arguably one of the most popular, recognized songs in the Weather Report catalog. You know, all that false harmonic stuff, all that. So it's interesting because he's recognized for the sound of the fretless and all that. But he definitely made a statement on his fretted too, you know.
You mentioned his, Jaco's attitude. What about his personality appealed to you?
I just felt there was a daredevil quality to what he brought to the performance. You know, Jaco was an entertainer. You know, his father, I guess, back in the day was also an entertainer, and he instilled that in Jaco. You know, you want to entertain, you know. So what Jaco was pulling from, you know, he was pulling from Jimi Hendrix, you know, and he was pulling from the Beatles, and he was pulling from classical music. And so as a performer, I'm sure he was trying to push the limits too, you know, like just feeling it. And that's why we say, he's often referred to as, you know, the punk of jazz, you know, punk jazz is referenced, because he wasn't one to have the rule, you know, create rules or barriers or anything. I always say that Jaco would have probably been the first one, you know, if there was a Slayer, for instance, Slayer's playing somewhere and the time's right, I think Jaco would have been the first one to jump in the slam pit, you know. and have no problem jamming with various types of musicians. I know on the after the Ian Hunter album, you know, All American Alien Boy, you know, there was a lot of people in the rock world that wanted to work with him. There's a lot of rumors out there, but I know like David Bowie, for instance, was very interested in Jaco, and then, you know, he hooked up with Joni Mitchell and they had this collaboration, but it wasn't like Jaco was this Joni Mitchell fan or anything. He just could adapt to, you know, any situation that you put him in, you know, and he would have his sound. And I guess all that comes with attitude, whether you're creating in the studio or you're collaborating as a writer or you're getting on stage and you're putting baby powder there and you're delivering the goods that way. Because I remember at the Santa Monica Civic, I thought it was so cool. He had the baby powder laid out on the stage, and then he actually set his bass down and he slid into it like it was sliding into home plate, you know. And I'd never seen anyone do that stuff. You know, doing flips, all this crazy cool stuff.
That adaptability, that throwing himself wholeheartedly into whatever musical setting he was in, is that an ethic that you have brought to Metallica after having done so many different things?
Well, you know, when I joined Metallica, you know, obviously I had a fairly solid career leading up, and I've always just tried to be myself in any situation. I think the a lot of the misunderstanding with me as a player is, okay, you know, a lot of maybe sort of younger players today who are really into Jaco may not understand, okay, you know, where's this coming from? Well, Robert Trujillo saw Jaco, you know, back in the day. I was fortunate. I'm going to be 50 this year, so I was able to experience that side of Jaco personally, you know. And I had another experience with him kind of in person on a side note. But
You want to tell me about that?
Yeah. I'll tell you that in 1 second. But he, you know, his influence, you know, just really, really kind of moved a lot of us back then, and we bring that into what we do in terms of the attitude with Metallica. You know, I kind of try to cater to the music as it needs to be. There are moments where I'm thinking about Jaco and I'm pumping, you know. There's a song called The Day That Never Comes, and I specifically thought about him in there. Now, I'm not playing a fretless on that song, but, you know, there's some moments where I'm really just pumping. And he comes to mind, you know. But again, you know, I mean, there's stuff that I'm writing in other situations, and Jaco is linked to that directly. I pull from a lot of my influences, as he did, you know, definitely. So I'll tell you this little story, if you're ready for it. It would have been in 1985, I think. There was a guitar show in Los Angeles. It was called the Los Angeles Guitar Show. And it was in Hollywood at a place called the Merlin Hotel, which I believe is now like a Holiday Inn Express, maybe over there on Highland, kind of around the Hollywood Bowl. And each hotel room was a sort of sponsored by a different guitar company or an amp company or a, you know, outboard, some sort of outboard gear company or whatever. And it's like the kind of a poor man's NAMM show, you know. And, you know, I'm in this one room and I hear somebody's cranked the bass all the way up. I mean, just cranked it. The walls are shaking. The windows are shaking. It was scary. It was like an earthquake. And so at the time, I was kind of like, man, you know, what's going on? You know, is it an earthquake? But then at the same time, it was like, wait, or is it some guy who's being obnoxious, you know, with an instrument, you know? So I actually was the first one to walk in this room, which was probably right across the hall or next door. And it was Jaco. He's sitting there. I was the first one in. There was a guitar rep in there. And I was blown away. There's my hero. So I actually sat down in front of him. And then the room started to fill up. Because everybody started talking about it, and next thing you know, the room's packed. And he starts playing, and he starts playing memorable, recognizable, you know, like soulful bass lines and stuff that, you know, would equate to him and his catalog. And also just some nice Otis Redding lines and you know, which would have been more in the Jerry Jamont kind of flavor. And he didn't say one word at anybody. He looked... It was almost like he was looking at each individual right into your eyes. I remember he's looking right at us, looking right at me, and just checking us out, but didn't say anything. And then his girlfriend at the time, Terry Nagel, Terry, beautiful girl, she came in the room and she was like, "Come on, Jocko, let's go," you know. And he got up and he put the bass down and he was out of there, you know. And I noticed she had a couple of cans of beer, you know, in her pocket. But she's kind of like a surfer girl. She looked like a surfer girl, and that was an interesting moment for me, because at the time it wasn't at the height of his career necessarily, you know, but he was still our hero. And what I thought was, like, you know, it was more like an organic thing where he reminded me of my friends that were like skateboarders back in the day who were professional, and they were daredevils, incredible skateboarders, surfers, just really, really great. But at the same time, you know, they were just cruising, you know, they were, you know, hanging out at the beach and cruising. It was like a cruise control, I call it. And he had that energy to him that day, for better or worse, whatever, however you want to take it. But it was just great to see him. Sometimes I think to myself, why didn't I invite him out for a burger or something, or a beer or whatever? You know, it's like, you know, that was the closest I got to him, you know, aside from being a spectator out in the crowd.
Do you recall hearing about his death in 1987?
Yes, I was actually not recording not too far from here, and I was working on, believe it or not, I was actually working on the demos. It was just before the demos for Infectious Grooves. I was working on some real heavy kind of funk R&B stuff at the time, but it was the same studio. It was a home studio in Hancock Park. And word had spread that Jocko had passed away. And, you know, we were all floored. You know, it was very sad and tragic. Things had gotten a bit more quiet for Jocko at that time. And you heard a lot of rumors leading up to that incident in that day or that night. So it was definitely a time of mourning for a lot of bass players back then. And I remember when I heard about it, I remember the weather, it was a nice day and all that. And I was in the studio recording, yeah.
So you've become sort of his patron, the steward. You've sort of appointed yourself steward of his legacy. You've been trying to raise awareness of him and his music. How did that happen?
Well, I don't know. In some ways, I almost feel like I don't know if inherited is the right word, but basically, you got to go back to 96 or 95, somewhere around there. I became friends with Johnny Pastorius, Jocko's eldest son. And Johnny was a fan of Suicidal Tendencies and my other band, which was the Infectious Grooves. And we started communicating. And that happened because we had a mutual friend who was working as a bartender in Fort Lauderdale. And Johnny came in with some friends. He put down his credit card to, I guess, buy a round of drinks. And my friend, Russell, who I used to surf with when he come through California, he notices the credit card and he sees John Pastorius, and he's like, "Hey, that name's sounds very familiar to me. I have a great friend who's a bass player in that name. I've heard him talk about Pastorius." He goes, oh, that's Jaco, that's my father, you know. So right there, you know, he's like, wow, you got to get you guys connected. And Johnny came to see me with Ozzy Osbourne in 1996. He came to a show, and we became friends immediately. We really hit it off. And we stayed in contact after that. You know, every year or two, we'd reconnect. But one of the first things I told him back then is I had said, you know, you should share your father's story, because there's a lot of musicians, a lot of creative people out there that really, really love and respect your father and his legacy. And the story is not one-dimensional, and it's not catering to one style of music either. You know, it's very well-rounded, and it's important, you know. And he's like, yeah, you know. And so every couple of years, I'd hear about, you know, that they're doing a documentary film and they're putting something together. And, you know, another couple of years would go by, another couple of years. And so finally, when I was with Metallica, I want to say it was about 4 years ago, Johnny Pastorius brought a good friend of the family's and of his, a gentleman by the name of Bob Bobbing. And Bob had actually, during his teenage years, hung out with Jaco. They were fellow bass players, and Bob produced an audio piece, basically an audio documentary about Jaco called Portrait of Jaco, the Early Years. And Bob was impressed with the energy of Metallica in the show, and he was impressed by the fact that here's this bass player who's playing in this huge rock band who's a huge fan of Jaco. And after the show, I was telling him, yeah, you know, you should, I was just, you know, telling him from my perspective of what would be really cool, I thought, you know, pertaining to Jaco and in the story, and also bringing awareness to the fact that there are players like Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers or Geddy Lee from Rush, you know, and, you know, it's a well-rounded contingent of rock musicians and, you know, gospel musicians. I mean, I knew a lot of different style players that were really influenced by Jaco. So all of that sort of developed into us starting to work together and motivating and sort of getting on this mission to put a documentary film together. And once I moved to Los Angeles, you know, the doors started to open wider. And Passion Pictures, a gentleman by the name of John Batzik, stepped on board. Now, Passion Pictures won the Academy Award a little over a year ago for Searching for Sugarman. They had, you know, a lot of success with other films like Restrepo or Once in a Lifetime about the New York Cosmos, the Pat Tillman story, you know, and go on and on. So that's kind of when things started kicking off in a different direction. So here we are now, you know, like I said, it's been almost 4 years. And I think things happen for a reason, because the fact that we're in 2014 and we're celebrating, you know, Jaco Pastorius through Record Store Day, and also releasing later in the year a film about him is pretty cool.
Well, we'll get back to Record Store Day in a second, but IMDb now says that the film comes out in November. Is that aspirational, or is that going to happen?
If you ask me, that's going to happen. So if it doesn't happen, everyone can come after me and come get me. But we are editing right now. It's definitely a project. We've had several rough cuts. It's very important at the same time that everyone involved is happy with what's developing and what's being created. That I think one of the things too is there's a lot of amazing treasures in this project. You have Super 8 footage, you know, from Jaco's youth. You've got an arsenal of interviews, you know, ranging. I mean, there's I think over 75 interviews. Not you know, of course you can't get them all in the film, but so you're trying to balance all this. And I'm not I'm not the director. I'm not telling the story. You know, it's not like Robert Trujillo's, you know, story, so to speak. You know what I mean? It's, I'm the conduit who's just trying to get this out there and get it right as close to possible. Hopefully after this, you know, there'll be sort of that the movement to where more people will get inspired and involved and continue with Jaco's legacy and having that they would have learned about him more. And I'm just trying to help, really.
Well, you're as I understand it, financing the film. Do you also have some creative input?
Oh yeah, I mean, I should, you know, I would. I'd be angry if I didn't. So, and I'd be lying if I didn't. I think that a project like this, it's definitely important that, you know, Johnny Pastorius and Mary and Felix and Julius are the twins, Jaco's younger sons, and they're also amazing musicians. But even, you know, Gregory Pastorius has been really, really helpful. That's Jaco's brother, who's a couple years younger than him. But at the same time, you know, our editor and director and all this, it's a challenge, but you want to try and incorporate everyone's feelings and envision as much as possible. So that's kind of where I come in. I try to navigate through the difficult times where we're trying to get things right and, you know, and get this thing to the finish line, but the right way, you know, with the best intentions. It's definitely a passion piece. There are times where I think to myself, like, I could never do this again because it's involved on a lot of different levels. There's a lot of time invested, but also, you know, they always say sort of when you're your sweat, your blood, your guts, like everything that goes into something. That's powerful. You know, it's amazing how many different edits have gone down and trying different things. And you know, you get to a certain point in the project, all of a sudden another treasure comes in because about a year in, we had gotten word that there was a box of audio cassettes, you know, from Conrad Silver's, I guess it would be Conrad Silver's sister, and, you know, helping with the project. And, you know, so photographs often come in. Michael Kurtz from Record Store Day had filmed Jaco back in 1978 with his Super 8 camera. So that came into the mix, you know, to Jaco on his first tour when he's coming through North Carolina through Michael Kurtz, who was instrumental in getting us to the celebration for 2014. So a lot of things kind of happen at the last minute too. And then all of a sudden you got to regroup and you got to try different things.
There's a lot of stuff in the Jaco Pastorius story that I imagine would be a lot of fun to tell. But ultimately, this is a man who had struggles with mental illness throughout his life, whose career went up and down, and who ultimately died in a bar fight. Is it difficult dealing with that in the context of the film, especially when his family is so closely involved?
It is difficult because there's obviously different sides to the story. And, you know, obviously we weren't there to, you know, to know exactly what happened. You know, you can only get it from people's ideas of what may have happened. So that's always a challenge, you know, you do the best you can. The other thing too is Jaco had a sense of humor. Jaco, it wasn't like a lot of people think, oh, you know, there's this tragic, depressing tale about this gifted genius of a musician, not just a bass player, but a musician. But Jaco had a great time in life, you know. Jaco, you know, had a lot of energy, loved to do things. He was active in a lot of different ways. He had a good heart. You know, of course, he was dealing with certain demons and stuff, you know, as a lot of creative people do. But he had a good time, and he was a practical joker. So there's also that side of his personality, always smiling, you know, and wanting to make people feel good, you know. So there's a lot of the positive stuff in the mix and all this too, you know. A lot of these people, and they share their story, you know. It's not all humdrum, you know. It's a lot of these people are enjoying sharing the special stories and the times that they had with them. And the guy definitely had a sense of humor. So I don't want people to think that they're going to watch this and, you know, it's going to be this journey down this dark path, you know. That's not what all this is about.
Well, we're talking to you this week because Saturday is Record Store Day. The film that you're helping to make about Jaco is the official film of Record Store Day this year. And the official record of Record Store Day is an album of some, as I understand it, some never before fully heard early Jaco recordings. Tell us about that.
It's very interesting. Basically, Michael Kurtz, who had seen a trailer, a 7-minute trailer that we had put together for an event called Bass Player Live, which is basically an event that Bass Player Magazine has in Los Angeles once a year. And they were honoring Jaco with a Lifetime Achievement Award. So Mary Pastorius and Julius and Johnny came out to Los Angeles and stayed with me. And we basically were there for them to accept the award. But at the same time, we needed to present at least a trailer of what was kind of going on. So Paul Marchand, our editor slash director, he put this really great 7-minute piece together. And Michael Kurtz, he saw this and he basically fell in love with it. He thought it was powerful. He invited us to the International Record Store Day dinner not too long after. And we showed the same trailer and everybody in the room was really, really into it. There were a combination of tears. There's even moments of joy. And so it was really special. At that point, that's when he asked if Jaco would, if we would want to make the film, you know, something that could be released under the Record Store Day banner for 2014, but also, you know, the possibility of maybe other releases for Jaco. And he set up a meeting with Cheryl Powalski, I believe her last name, but she's from Omnivore Records. And Johnny and myself met with Michael Kurtz and Cheryl in Santa Monica over at the Earth Cafe. And Johnny says, you know, we're talking about, oh, you know, it'd be great if there was some music that could be released. And Johnny says, oh, yeah, you know, we got the original acetate from the Criteria Sessions. And it was like, what? You know, this is never before heard, you know. The demos, basically, the demo recordings for the first solo album. And at that point, you know, I think everybody got pretty excited and started to put that project together. So basically, in a nutshell, I mean, it's Jaco with just full of fire and amazing creative spirit and the attitude. I always say it's that daredevil kind of punk attitude in his delivery and how he's playing, just super tight. It's great to hear these compositions, you know, different versions of these jams of these compositions that would appear on his first solo record. There's even some stuff that didn't appear on the solo record. So you've got some special other compositions and it's just pure attitude. And it's amazing that someone could play with that precision and that feel and that just ranging from the funk to the dynamic melodic voice that he had through his instrument at a young age. I mean, he must have been 22 years old back then. So that's very exciting for us to be able to launch that for Record Store Day in celebration of Record Store Day.
You've touched on this already, but I think I should go ahead and ask you outright. A lot of people might be surprised that Robert Trujillo, this, you know, you see him on stage with Metallica and he looks like a beast, this beast of metal, the most famous and successful metal bass player alive right now, is the champion of this relatively obscure jazzer. Why should people not be surprised by that?
Well, I'll tell you an interesting thing about Metallica is, for one thing, not having anything to do with directly with Jaco, but you know, he'd kill me for saying band leader, but drummer Lars Ulrich, his godfather is Dexter Gordon. And he grew up around a lot of jazz music because of his father, Torben. Torben, back in Copenhagen, Denmark, there was a lot of that incredible energy coming from jazz music, and a lot of these players would roll through Copenhagen, spend a lot of time there, play gigs and hang out. You know, there was less restrictions, and there weren't probably any rules as to who you hung out with or what music you listened to. So Lars grew up around jazz music, and as crazy as it sounds, I mean, whether someone can swing or whatever you want to say in that, you know, it's definitely apparent in terms of arrangement and you know, developing sort of you know, in terms of the song, traditional song, the rock and roll song arrangement, it's not what Metallica does, you know? A lot of progressive, interesting things going on in the bodies of music over the years. And a lot of that, I think, is inspired by the fact that Lars, you know, not necessarily being a jazz player, musician, that influence is there. It's in him, you know? It's just, it's a part of the DNA in the songwriting. I went to a jazz school. I went to Dick Grove School of Music, probably around, would have been in 1984. And so I spent some time around a lot of different types of jazz musicians and did a lot of jamming and, you know, went through the program and came out of it and ended up playing rock music, joining Suicidal Tendencies and, you know, always driven by the funk, though. Always really, always had my feet firmly planted in that style. So I don't think it should be such a surprise. You know, we'd be surprised that there's a lot of musicians out there that are lovers of jazz. You know, Flea actually plays trumpet, a lot of jazz trumpet. Went to USC School of Music about 2 years ago, got a degree, you know. Started playing piano and getting all into jazz voicings and broadening his horizons, so to speak. You know, you'd be surprised. There's a lot of players out there that appreciate that. And then again, a lot of some of that cool older jazz music. It's just full of attitude. You know,
you are probably by any metric, ticket sales, dollars, artistic success, you know, among the most successful bass players alive right now. Does that give you a sense of responsibility to fly the flag for your tribe, so to speak? And is that where this Jaco project comes out of, that impulse?
Well, you know, it's kind of a weird thing for me. I always try to stay grounded, you know. I never really, you know, throughout my career, it's always been baby steps. It's like back when I was a teenager playing in backyard party bands, you know, playing Ozzy Osbourne's music, you know, 17 years old, Black Sabbath, Van Halen, all this stuff, Led Zeppelin. You know, it was like the goal was to like learn a particular song at the time. Then all of a sudden it's like, oh, there's this really great singer, you know, who's a couple years older, who lives on the other side of town. I hope someday that I can work with that singer, you know. And then all of a sudden they come see you at some barbecue playing. And then from there, you join that band, and then it's just this process that happened in my career. I never thought about, you know, that like I'm going to join the biggest band in the world. But I'll tell you an interesting fact, and it was a joke, actually. In my high school yearbook at Culver High, I actually had written in there, you know, for my kind of my final, you know, goodbye to the world of high school education. I had said, hopefully someday I'll be rich and famous, you know, and be in a band like Led Zeppelin in my thing. So it's kind of a weird situation. But again, I always believe in staying grounded and appreciating where you came from and never restricting yourself to rules according to style. And you know, obviously being the best you can be as a player, but also as a human being, and staying humble, you know, it's very important. One of the things about being in Metallica is there's a very strong work ethic. You know, I joined the band and I was in very challenging situations where it was like, okay, you're going to be on TV in front of millions of viewers, and there's this medley that we got to play. And maybe I would have learned the medley like 5 days before, and we would not have rehearsed it until we're going up to play it. A little sound check rehearsal. That's a lot to take when you're going to be on camera in front of millions of people. Those are the new challenges now. It's like, ooh, because at the end of the day, you can't be the one that's, you know, necessarily being the one making the mistakes or blowing it, you know, because my bandmates, especially Lars and James, give you that death stare. It's heavy, you know, it's heavy. So it's been an incredible, challenging journey, you know, but always stay humble, you know.
Well, as we wrap up here, looking to the future, the film comes out. What impact do you hope that it has in the world? What will you call a success from all of your efforts around Jaco Pastorius?
Well, the success for me is the awareness in bringing attention to you know, his ability to compose, and also bringing, and this is where anyone can really learn from and pull from, you know, is the attitude. And I mean that in the most positive way, is in life, knowing that you can achieve something if you put your heart and soul into it and you believe. A lot of the things that Jaco was doing as a composer, it was sort of like, you know, you check out that first album or even Word of Mouth, the second album, and you're going, wow, there's a lot here. There's a lot to digest, and it's all great, you know? I mean, Jaco could have easily made, there's a song called Come On, Come Over off the first album with Sam and Dave singing, incredibly funky, incredibly funky. And you think, well, why didn't Jaco just do a whole album of Come On, Come Overs? You know, like it would have been, you know, no disrespect to Tower of Power, because I love Tower of Power, but in some ways, you know, that could have been the ultimate Tower of Power. You know, what an incredible statement to like funk and R&B. You know, but then you hear these really dynamic, classical, almost classical-like, you know, versions of him sort of doing solo accompaniments or just really controlling the melody and everything and bringing the bass into that realm. So there's a whole nother thing going on. Well, he was just so well-rounded. So I believe that even on Ian Hunter's album, which is basically a rock album, you know, and his presence is still felt. What he did with Joni Mitchell, you know, the personality is still there. His voice is heard. So anything creative, you know, whether it's art and painting, you know, music, anything, you know, you be yourself and you make a statement as who you are and what you bring. You know, with Metallica, you know, I know where I like to be as a player within that band and how I like my voice to be heard. And, you know, James and Lars dominate the writing process. I mean, they've been there for over 30 years, you know. But at the same time, I know my role and I know where I like to be in that mix. And I also know my role, like on stage, I know how I fit in. I know what I want to do. I have so much fun up there. And I feel blessed, you know, on all fronts. So for Jaco, it's celebrating, you know, not just the compositions in his story, but also the spirit of who he is and what he brings to music, and I mean all music, you know.
Well, you know, I got to ask, how's the new Metallica record coming?
Actually, interesting. We put a song together for this. We did a 2-week run down in South America, and we actually put together a new song, and it has that old thrash quality to it. It's called Lords of Summer, and maybe not. Maybe it'll end up on the album. We'll see. I don't know. It doesn't always work out that way, but it's a fun song to play, and actually a lot of people like it. So the good thing about that is we've taken that huge step forward in the creative process. So we're writing. We're getting into it. And, we've been sidetracked over the last couple years with different creative adventures, but now we're going to focus on writing and keep that going. That's very important to us. So hopefully, a year from now, you know, we'll have a lot of music for our fans and anyone else who wants to check out Metallica's stuff. But I feel like we're in a good place. Death Magnetic, our last album, did incredibly well in a lot of ways. But more importantly, I feel it was the launch pad for what we're about to do. And the album took a long time to make because we had 5 children born during the creative process in that, you know, from sort of start to finish. I think there was about 5 kids born. So there was a lot of things happening at that time. I don't expect that'll happen in this next round of songwriting. So we'll deliver the goods.
Well, essentially, I mean, Death Magnetic was certainly the most progressive record that Metallica had made since And Justice for All, sort of really picked up where And Justice for All left off to my ear. Mm-hmm. And that, I imagine that made you very happy because you're a music nerd. You like progressive stuff. That's what we've been talking about for an hour now. Is the band continuing to move in that direction?
You know, it's funny because I don't even know if we can help it. You know, we've got so many riffs. A lot of times a band that's been around as long as Metallica, you know, the problem is coming up with ideas. You know, it's like, wow, you know, here we are in a situation where we're blessed or cursed with too many ideas. So what happens is you start figuring out ways to incorporate those ideas into your song, you know, and sometimes that means the song's going to, like, I think, I'm not sure at the song length of this last tune, I almost want to say 7 minutes or something, you know. And our managers just, they get so pissed off at us because, you know, you got to shorten the songs, you know, get to the point. So I don't know if we can control that, that angle to the songwriting process and that ingredient that is progressive, I guess you could say. But, you know, Death Magnetic was definitely influenced in a lot of ways by the older stuff. And it was sort of reconnecting with the thrash ingredient. And I feel blessed in a lot of ways because I was really into all that stuff, into the older Metallica stuff. And then I kind of lost track of, you know, a lot of the stuff that was going on during the Load and Reload years. Not to say I didn't like it or I don't like it now, you know, but I'm just saying that, you know, it's nice to be in the band now and have Metallica open to, you know, number one, suggestion, collaboration, and I feel that we've grown as a band with a lot of the challenges we've had in recent years, and in a lot of ways I feel we're better, you know. I'm not saying we're better than the previous bands, but for where we are as this unit, I think we're better, you know, with our unit right now and where we're at in our career. So it feels good. You know, it's nice to be in a place where you're excited. You know, you're still excited. We put on our instruments. We're still like teenagers. And that's a beautiful thing. You know, we're not burned out on it yet.
Well, Robert Trujillo, it has been such a pleasure. I, you know, my line of work, I actually get to interview my idols kind of often. It's very rare that I get to interview one of my idols about another one of my idols. It's been a unique and fascinating and wonderful experience.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed, you know, having this conversation and this interview. And I feel like this year is really special in a lot of ways. Things happen for a reason, and Jaco is happening right now. He's with us, and the magic is out there. So we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it continues. But it definitely feels like a launch pad right now.
Well, best of luck.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk to you. Bye-bye.
All right.